Hello and welcome to Jibe Talking, the Volvo Sailing Podcast. I'm Guy Swindles in France at the moment, and in this programme we catch up with Ian Williams ahead of the start of the Extreme 40 series in Oman. We have Iker Martinez and Xabi Fernandez fixing a dagger board in the middle of the Barcelona World Race. We talk to Daily Sail editor James Boyd about the difficulty in breaking round the world records these days. And Yachting World's Matt Sheehan looks forward to the Caribbean 600 race and getting a ticket for the sailing at the 2012 Olympics. But first, it's our old favourites, the Volvo Sailing Podcast news headlines. After Banque Populaire had to give up their Jules Verne trophy hopes, Thomas Colville is battling to keep up with the pace in his solo round-the-world attempt. In the Barcelona World Race, Verbeek Paprec 3 continues to lead. Matt Frey still second, despite a broken dagger board. More about that later. Ricardo Simonescia's Audi team wins the Melges 24 in Miami. And in Volvo Ocean Race news, Inmarsat will be providing fleet broadband for the third race running, while more competitors are lining up for the pre-race Legends Regatta. Watch this space. Well, delighted to say we're joined on this latest edition of the Volvo Sailing Podcast, Jibe Talking, by someone we've been lucky enough to speak to a few times over the years, Ian Williams, a double World Match Race Tour winner. And now turning attention not only to that, but to the Extreme 40 series. Ian, I have to say, you and Team Pindar have set yourself a bit of a challenge this year, haven't you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a big challenge doing both tours. It's obviously very different. One of them on one hull and one of them on two hulls, so quite different sailing. But I think it's going to be a lot of fun and as you say, a really good challenge.
Now, we catch up with you in Oman, don't we, at the moment, just ahead of, is that the first Extreme 40 regatta of the season?
Yeah, that's right. We've actually just arrived at the Wave in Oman. We just delivered the boat down, did a 40-mile delivery trip this morning from Musana, where we've been training, down to the Wave, and the boat's just come out to go through measurement.
How is the multi-hull going after spending most of your time perhaps in a single hull over the last few years?
Yeah, we've had 4 days training so far here in Oman, so it's certainly been a bit of a baptism of fire, but of course the learning curve is pretty much vertical at the moment, but you know, it's going well. We've had 4 really good days. Strong wind here, I think it's gonna lighten off in the next few days, so we're gonna get a little bit of lighter wind practice. And I guess we'll find out how it's going, you know, once we start the first event in, 5 days' time now.
Now, here you are preparing for the first event. The Extreme 40, of course, has been going for a little while. But obviously looking to grow this year. What's the kind of buzz around the place from the people who have been sailing in the series before and newcomers like yourself?
Well, I think certainly the intensity and the level of the competition has gone up this year. I think it's unusual to see so many teams so organised and training so hard so far in advance of the first regatta. So I certainly feel that the bar has been raised, particularly with a couple of America's Cup teams coming in and a couple of previous America's Cup teams certainly bringing, you know, a great deal of resource to the event. And you know, I think it's going to make for a great season.
Now, Ian, what was behind the decision to double up, if you like, this season?
Oh well, you know, Team GAC Pindar is sort of been an evolving team over last year. It was very much a starter year for GAC as a sponsor coming into the sport, and they enjoyed both tours. They enjoyed their experiences on the World Match Racing Tour, and they also enjoyed the two events that the team did on the Extreme Sailing Series. So we thought we'd take the plunge and go for both, and see how we got on.
Ian, do you think, given the America's Cup's now gone multi-hull, that it is important almost to be an all-rounder now, to be able to sail both multi and mono-hull?
I think it's one of the great things about our sport is the diversity, and there's always a different challenge that you can go into, and that's, you know, really enjoyable. is it important to be able to do both? Well, for the America's Cup, it's now important to be a good multi-hull sailor. For some other big events, it's important to be a good monohull sailor. And really, it's for any individual to sort of choose, you know, where their future head takes them.
Do you, given that you're so busy at the moment, I don't want to sort of talk about the future so much, but you have mentioned there's so many opportunities at the moment. As a sort of top ranking sailor, are you almost spoilt for choice these days?
Oh, I'm not sure spoiled for choice is the word. Obviously, we're coming out of a global recession, I guess, and so I think a lot of sailors have found it hard to find, you know, professional sailors have found it hard to find work over the last few years. But certainly, I think there's a lot more sort of positive feeling around, and there are more opportunities out there. That's a good thing for us, for sure.
Now I've been lucky enough to fly around a couple of times on an Extreme 40. We've talked about sort of the serious sailing and obviously looking to win titles and things like that, but they are fun, aren't they?
Yeah, we're having a great time. We've only had 4 days, so the first day you really spend your time just sort of holding on and trying to get an idea of what's going on, particularly for me, new to catamarans as well. But I think over the last few days we sort of got a little bit more settled, a little bit more comfortable, and the enjoyment factor comes in a bit more. We've just done almost a downwind delivery in about starting off in 12 knots and building to about 18 knots down here to the wave, about 40 miles, and you know what a blast. We just came down here at, well, we don't have a speedo, but we were thinking probably doing somewhere between 12 and 18 knots all the way down, and you know, it's been a lot of fun.
So, for the rest of the season, where are you heading to with Extreme 40s? Where have you got to go to for the World Match Race Tour, and how are your air miles coming along?
Yeah, well, it's going to be a lot of travelling. Obviously, we're starting here in Oman, and then the next event is Qingdao in China in April. And then I think the next one for me would be the first of the World Match Racing Tour in France. So it's starting off really with a focus on the Extreme 40s, and then the World Match Racing Tour comes online a little bit later in the year.
Well, Ian, thanks so much for joining us. Good luck sorting everything out this year, but I hope everything goes well and you enjoy yourself at Oman this weekend. Well, next is off to the Barcelona World Race, where Iker Martinez and Xabi Fernandez ran into a few problems with a broken daggerboard. Our thanks to the Barcelona World Race website for this audio.
We have a couple of collisions during the race, since we started the race. We didn't know exactly what was, if that was a box or plastic box, or that was an animal or whatever it is. On the last one we have, we didn't feel anything bad, but after some hours, the boat was vibrating quite a lot. So we have a look and we saw the daggerboard was not 100%. No, so we knew already that the daggerboard was broken. We didn't know how much, but we knew that was bad. No, anyway, we were going upwind for the gate. And we decide to keep going and then see after that how much we break and how was it, no? So after crossing that, we have a reaching conditions, so we're able to put the daggerboard out, and we saw that we're missing like a meter and a half of daggerboard, and that's where we decide to start repairing or trying to repair that. No, we were not sure if we're gonna made it or not, but we decided, okay, we have to try. No, if not, we're gonna have to stop in New Zealand, and obviously we have to try everything before that. No, because from now to Cape Horn, I mean, it's not super bad, but after that you need a daggerboard. If not, you cannot go up with it, no? So we start first trying to repair bottom part, trying to make useful the bottom or the maximum deep section, as the middle of the dugout, or the one the structure was there, so we were putting some forms that we have there for our seat outside. So now it's not so comfortable anymore outside because we don't have the seat anymore. But we're more than happy that it's on the dugout. So it was difficult to glue and everything, but we managed to do the shape again. Well, not a perfect shape, but more or less good. And then was the most difficult part, was the lamination, no? So we started the lamination, but then was getting dark, and then we have again like 20 to 25 knots. So in the morning we saw that was completely wet and was not I mean was not good. So then we decided to try to move the dugout, no, very careful, and because the boat was moving quite a lot. So we managed to move the dugout and put the brake part of the dugout here inside the boat, just through here, and the rest of the dugout outside. Obviously, there is not room enough in this boat for the dugout completely inside, no? So we managed to do this, and the dugout was almost touching the rudder, but we find the right place, no, there. And after that was more easy here inside, as we didn't have the humidity from that we have on the outside. But then anyway, the temperature was very low, was less than 10 degrees. So was not going as fast as we needed, no? Because then we knew that in a couple of days we needed a dugout, no? So, and the strong winds, they were coming again, and we didn't want to have the dugout here in the middle and moving, and it was pretty dangerous. So we have to do this before. So we were putting like a little tent here inside, and we were putting the engine on the same time that we were trying to charge the batteries. Like this, we were trying to dry a little bit and keep the warm inside. So was drying, the stratification was drying a little bit, and then we have to put a part outside because it didn't get hard. So not a pretty good job, but at least we were keep going and moving forward. And then the last part was just trying to have a little better finish for have this on the water, no? Once again, was not drying, everything, no? But the most difficult was that the only time we have was the time that we're sleeping, no? So we have to spend 5 or 6 days just almost not sleeping, and that was very, very hard, no? Trying to lose less miles with the other boats, but on the same time, you're not sailing, you're looking for your boat, for the dugout, no? And we were not putting a lot of heel on the boat, and well, these kind of things that help you to do these things. And then when we finished, that was just then the maneuver to put dugout outside again, that was pretty difficult, and put the dugout in, that is difficult when sailing, no? So we managed to do it, didn't break again the dugout, and now is there. Not a perfect shape, but it's there. We don't want to stop in New Zealand. Today is not in our plans to stop in New Zealand.
Good.
I mean, if we break something before we arrive to New Zealand that we have to stop, obviously we will stop. But if not, we don't gonna stop. I mean, the boat now is ready to keep going.
Well, the podcast wouldn't be the same without a regular dose of Matt Sheehan, Yachting World's technical editor, who's off to do a spot of rather nice sailing. What's all going on, Matt?
Absolutely, Guy. Yes, I have got a trip coming up. It's the Royal Ocean Racing Club's Caribbean 600, which starts on Monday. It starts on Monday the 21st, and it's the new race. This is the third time they've held it, and it's basically a contorted trip around the Caribbean islands, but albeit a 600-mile offshore trip. But it's a fascinating race for anybody who's not familiar with it. It weaves its way in and around just about all the islands between. It starts at Antigua, it weaves its way all the way up to Anguilla, going around St. Martin and various other islands, then it shoots down past Montserrat, the volcanic island down there, round Guadeloupe, and then all the way back up for another circumnavigation of Antigua to a finish. And it looks like a superb race.
This race has been growing a bit. I hate to use the word, but perhaps started as a little bit of a jolly, but now it's getting increasingly competitive, and more of the world's top offshore sailors seem to be taking part.
Absolutely, that's absolutely right. And I suppose, you know, you could just take the view and say, well, you look at the weather we've had in the northern part of Europe in the last few weeks, last few months, it's not difficult to see why the Caribbean might be appealing at this time of the year. But I think it's more than that. I think it is a genuinely interesting race. Certainly the people who've taken part in the previous two events have come back saying that is a really interesting 600 mile race, because actually none of the legs are very long. There's always something going on all the time. But anyway, whatever the reasons are for people going back, there's certainly some pretty interesting competition stacking up for this year. I mean, in the big boats, Leopard's going to be there. Obviously, she's a very familiar boat, the 100-foot Far design. Then she's going to be up head-to-head against Rambler, another 100-foot Maxi there. And Genuine Risk, the Cantinquiel 98-footer. Now, we haven't seen much of her for quite a while. She's an Ed Dubois design from a few years back, but she's quite a potent machine. So certainly those three alone are going to have quite a ding-dong as they go around. Then of the other interesting boats that are there, there's the new Simon Rogers 82-footer Aegir, which is the one that I'm going to be sailing on. There's also in the list of new boats, there's the new Humphreys 54, that's son of Humphreys, that's Tom Humphreys, Robert Humphreys' son, has designed the new Oyster Catcher, which is a sort of pumped-up TP52, I guess, and that's for Richard Matthews. That's just been put in the water for, I think, Key West was their first event, and this will be their second event. Then there's scores of Class 40s. That seems to be the thing to have nowadays. There's plenty of Class 40s charging around. But it's not all Grand Prix boats either. I mean, there's a long list of mainstream boats as well, from Beneteau 40.7 in there. I see a Far 40. I see an Archambault 40. There's lots of sort of mainstream boats, as you might call them. And in fact, going down to, I think, the smallest boat so far in the 35-boat fleet is actually a Jeannot Wonderdyne, a JOD 35. That's from quite a few years back. So a really interesting mix of boats in this event. And I think sort of clarification that it is actually appealing to a very broad church.
Well, Matthew, have enormous fun and I hope you win. It should be a terrific event, and we look forward to hearing about it all on the next podcast. But in the meantime, news just out about Olympics 2012, and something a bit different perhaps as far as sailing fans are concerned.
Absolutely. Well, we've all known, certainly in the UK, it's impossible to ignore or have missed the fact that the UK, London in particular, will be hosting the 2012 Olympics. But the sort of excitement has sort of raised up another few notches now, because as of the 15th of February, the schedule was announced for all 650, yes, that's 650 sporting events that actually make up the whole of the Olympics. There's apparently 8.8 million tickets to be sold, so it's quite an event. But of course, we're probably more interested in the sailing side of it. That's down at Weymouth. That venue's been built and has been used several times already, and already people are saying that it's going to be a terrific site. I'm sure it will be for the Olympics, but there's going to be a big difference this time. And the big difference from a spectator point of view, it's just that. Spectators will be more than welcome at the Weymouth Olympics, and in fact, there's going to be ticketing for the Olympics. Now, for the Sailing Olympics. Now, the precise details of exactly what you get for your money have yet to be firmed up and announced, but we understand that just in terms of the costing of tickets, it's going to range from £20, and that's for the first day of the Olympics, which is the 29th of July, up to £55 for the medal races, which start on the 5th of August and run through to the end. Now, from what we understand, there are two main aspects of this ticketing that are going to happen. One is ticketing for the arena, if you like, which is actually on a place called the Node, which is very close to the Old Harbour in Weymouth, and that overlooks one of the course areas. and that course area is going to be the medal race area, and it's going to be like an outdoor arena where you pay your money, you go up there, and there's commentary, I guess, and there's going to be seating and a grandstand view of that race course. But we also understand that there are plans to have spectator boats available, official spectator boats, that you actually go out and go and watch some of the racing. Those details have yet to be released. It'll be interesting to see how the organisers go about doing it, because as anybody who's been to Sail for Gold will know and has been in that area will know, Weymouth Bay is an enormous area. It's something like 55 square kilometres. It's a huge area with six racecourse areas on it. So it's not just a question of going out and sitting in the middle and watching all the racing. It's going to be interesting to see what the plans are for where the spectator boats go. That's all yet to come. But the really interesting thing, as I say, is that it will be ticketed. And that in itself puts a certain degree, an extra amount of pressure now on the organisation, because having asked people to pay for a ticket, the sport and the organisers now have to actually lay something on. So it's going to be interesting to see how they respond to that. Certainly as far as the number of people that are expected to go, talking to Rob Andrews, who is the sailing manager for LOCOG, so he's head of the tree for the Sailing Olympics, he told us that this was just towards the end, by the end of last year, before the official registration push had really sort of started, 300,000 people had registered already just to go and see the Sailing Olympics itself, which is a fascinating number, and that he was expecting up to 4,500 people a day in Weymouth. So this could be something very, very different indeed. But these are all numbers, it's all theories, it's all speculation perhaps to a certain degree. The important thing for any sailing fan is to actually get online, register, because you're going to need to register for tickets, and you can do that as from the 15th of March. That's when tickets go on sale. You can register during that period. It's a six-week period, and it's not on a first-come, first-served basis. Basically, you tick the sports and the days that you want to buy tickets for. When the application process closes, a few weeks after that, you then find out whether you've been successful, and then you end up paying for your tickets. So a very, very different format for sailing and spectator sailing than we've been used to in the past.
Well, welcome back to the Volvo Sailing Podcast. Jibe talking to the Daily Sail editor, James Boyd. There's been a bit of activity around the globe recently as far as sailing's concerned. It's the Barcelona World Race, of course. A couple of record attempts also going on, and much more besides. But James, can we, if we could just start perhaps with one round-the-world record attempt that's failed, Banque Populaire, and also Thomas Colville on Sidibo, who is struggling a little with the solo challenge. What have you made of those campaigns, and perhaps why were they less successful perhaps than they'd hoped?
I think the thing to point out, Guy, is that these records are actually becoming incredibly hard to beat. The fully crewed round the world record, which is the one which Banque Populaire was going for, that was first broken in 1993, I think it was, become known as the Jules Verne Trophy. And at that point, we didn't know if boats could make it around the world in 80 days. And since then, the record has almost halved. I mean, I think it's somewhere in the early 40s now. So it's incredibly hard to break. And to do that, you need literally everything to come right for you. You need all the weather windows, of which there are obviously numerous on the very long around the world racetrack, to come good for you. You need to make sure that it's a given that you have to do it in a fast boat, and obviously you have to have a very well prepared crew, but you also have to make sure the boat doesn't break. And obviously when Groupama did it last year, that was actually her third attempt after two failed ones where they had issues with the boat, one nearly catastrophic on the first time they went around. So unfortunately, that's the fate which befell Banque Populaire this time. And Banque Populaire is unquestionably the fastest offshore boat in the world at the moment. She demolished the transatlantic record last year. And so she's got all the right credentials to do it. She's got a very good crew. They've both been thoroughly well prepared. And amazingly, they've been waiting for a year and a half, I think it is, to actually find the correct weather window to leave on. So they found it. They've been working. I think they've been on standby since November, and then they left in January. And unfortunately, they had some issues. They were ahead of the record all the way down the Atlantic, and then they got to the Southern Ocean, and then they had a collision with an object floating in the water, which they weren't able to identify. And that damaged their dagger board, and they tried to fix it in situ, but were really unable to do that. And with the whole of the Southern Ocean and literally three quarters of the race course left for them, left ahead of them, they decided to return to France. So, a very valiant effort. They were ahead of the Group Armour's time up until that point. But they unfortunately just had to throw the towel in. So anyway, they're going to return to France, and once their boat's fixed, they'll either look at, I think it's probably a bit late to head out again this year, but they'll probably look at going next year.
How about the solo attempt going on at the moment, James?
Well, we were talking about how hard the Banque Populaire, the Jules Verne Trophy record is to break, and if anything, the single-handed equivalent of that is even harder. It was set 3 years ago by Francis Joyon, who has become something of a legend in France. When he broke it, he broke Dame Ellen MacArthur's record. The benchmark time which he set is ridiculously fast. Again, I can't remember exactly, but it was in the early 70s for the number of days he took to sail around the world. And as I was saying at the beginning of our conversation, it was only 18 years ago that we didn't have a fully crewed boat could go around the world in less than 80 days, and Francis Joyon went to do it in 74. Now the thing is, so we now have Thomas Coville, who is a sailing a very similar boat to what Francis Joyon sailed around the world. It's by the same designers, Magellan's and Benoit Cabaret. It's slightly bigger, slightly more powerful, slightly more up to date, and Thomas is a sort of slightly younger guy. He's very dynamic. He's an athlete. He's done every sailing you can imagine, from the Bombay Globe to the America's Cup to bits of the whip, to the Volvo Ocean Race. I almost said Whitbread. He's a very talented sailor. But the thing is, the record which Joyon built, he was aside from being one of the greatest offshore sailors who's ever lived, he was extremely lucky with the weather. For example, Thomas was ahead of the record all the way down to just before the equator. And obviously, the way we follow these boats is we have Thomas's track, and we're following it against where Francis Joyon went and what his progress was. There's a similar time to where Thomas is. And he was able to cut the corner in the South Atlantic. Typically, you have a big high pressure system in the South Atlantic, and you have to sail all the way virtually down most of the coast of Brazil to get around it before you get into the Southern Ocean. And when Joyon went through, he was pretty much able to pass Rio and then turn his bow directly towards Cape Town. So he saved several hundred miles doing that, and literally in the course of 4 or 5 days, poor old Thomas, he's had to go the long way around the South Atlantic, has ended up being, I think this morning, he's 1,100 miles behind where Joyon was. So he's really got, it's not impossible for him to claw that back. He's, as I said, he's in a faster boat. If he gets some decent breaks with the weather, he'll be able to come back. But he's got a hell of a lot on if he's going to do it, because Joyon was not really slow in any part of his round-the-world record. So he's really got his work cut out.
Well, of course, we'll keep an eye on Thomas Colville's effort, but it's a bit busy round the globe at the moment, isn't it, with Velox, Five Oceans and the Barcelona World Race. It's a bit of a danger they'll collide out there, isn't there?
Well, yes, that's one of the things. It's a bit like the M25 out there at the moment, because we have the Velox Five Oceans, which is a single-handed round-the-world race with stops. So they left Wellington last weekend, and there's only, I think, four boats now doing that, because one dropped out. So they're just sort of setting up. They're sort of in the early stages of the Pacific. Then we've got the Barcelona World Race. I think there's 12 or 13 boats left in that. And the first boat in that race is due to... They go through Cook Strait, which is between North and South Island in New Zealand. And the first boat is due to go through there tomorrow. So they're not far behind the Velox Five Oceans. And then We've got Tomer, who's shortly to be coming up to the south of the Cape of Good Hope, obviously off South Africa, and he's going to end up steaming through the Barcelona World Race Fleet. So it is incredibly busy down there. And and then you could have had Bank Populaire going through the middle of all that loss as well. So yes, it's incredibly busy at the moment.
All this and the Volvo Ocean Race to come. James Boyd, editor of the Daily Sail, as always, thanks so much for your time. Well, that's it from the latest edition of Jibe Talking on the brand new Volvo Ocean Race website, amongst other places. So please remember to keep in touch. We'll be back again next time with all the latest from the world of sailing. And remember, in the meantime, to check in at regular intervals to www.volvooceanrace.com.